Let's, if you could bring everybody to their chairs, please, and we'll go ahead and get fired up here. Okay, I see the lights on, so we're operational. So let's go around the room and do introductions first of all. Let's actually start in the back of the room first, and then we'll just go right around and we'll.
My name is Rick Hartman with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Welcome.
Jeff Samuels, Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division.
Welcome.
I'm
sorry, the door was closing just when you...
Ed Morgan, Public Affairs Council.
Great, thank you.
Kevin Blakely, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Tony Schindler,
Paul Romaine with the Romaine Group.
Tom Wolf, Trout Unlimited.
Bob Olson with Northwest Sea Letters to Logan.
I'm Joe Rollinger, I'm Director of Fish and Wildlife.
I'm Jim Meyer, and I'm a wild fish advocate.
Ed Bold, ODFW.
Hey, sir, walking in.
Tyler Alexander from Oregon Farm Bureau.
Great, glad to have you here. Beth?
Beth Petrino, Committee Services Office.
Jim Owens, Coven Owens Green, Facilitator.
Jim Martin, representing the sport fishing industry.
Carrie Westland, Travel Lane County.
Brad Pettinger, Commercial Fisheries.
Rob Morrison, Leupold and Stevens.
Rob Ball, Nature Conservancy.
Mark Labhart, Association of Oregon Counties.
Paul Don Heppner, Oregon Hunters Association.
Nancy Bales, Gray Family Foundation.
Claire Pucci, retired from several organizations.
Scott Welch, Columbia Sportswear.
Bruce Taylor, one of the conservation representatives.
Mike Finley, Chair of the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Senator Doug Whitsett, District 28.
Kurt Melcher, Director of Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Great, welcome. And on the phone? On the phone, we have...
Kenji Sugihara, Executive Director, Oregon Bicycle Race Association, and Oregon Tourism Commission member.
Hi, Kenji. Anybody else?
Hey.
Anybody else on the phone? Okay, in the back of the room, Alicia?
Alicia Morton,
Green. Great. Okay. Yes, sir.
Mark, Mike Herbal.
So Beth will get that to you, and then we can text back to him. So,
so he should have gotten an email on Saturday with him?
Okay, so four things we're going to accomplish today before... So Mike, are you on? He'll beep in shortly. So we're going to discuss the stakeholder outreach program today and the results to date. We've had a few meetings. We're going to refine funding scenarios to be considered, get those down a little bit more in detail. We're going to have a little bit of tweaking to do on some of those. Review work group recommendations on funding objectives, funding scenarios, and other topics. And then I'd like to talk about the next steps in the process for developing a preliminary report for the legislature. I'm going to propose, so you can be thinking about it, another meeting in September. We're going to get our report pretty well finalized, hopefully in the next few weeks. Morning, Mike. Are you there?
Hello, I'm here.
Okay, great. Glad to have you on. And then hopefully we could get a meeting in September prior to the legislative session on the 22nd, isn't it, Beth? The 22nd of September, 22nd and 23rd? Yeah. So we can have just one more look at that. Welcome, Representative. So we're scheduled to adjourn no later than noon today. Want to end today's meeting hopefully with an agreement on how we plan to move forward with finalizing, vetting, and presenting the recommendations. And part of that conversation is going to be whether and when do we want to meet again. And again, that hopefully will you'll be an agreement that we can meet in September, sometime around the middle of September or so. So I think that's it for the wrap up of what we're going to do today. I turn it over to Jim, who's got some housekeeping items for us.
So this is travel time, and which means airplane time, and I was on a flight the other day, and this woman sits down next to me, and she says, "Hi, my name is Gertrude. It's so nice to meet you. I'm flying to New York for my grandson's 30th birthday. I'm really excited. I remember when he was just a little bumpkin, and now he's already three. It's really hard to believe. He's the most adorable thing you've ever seen. You know what? Hold on. I think I have a picture on me. Let me look in my purse. Yes, here it is. Just look at him. Isn't he adorable? Do you see his dimple on his left cheek? Simply adorable. I could stare at this picture all day. Oh, my, and you should hear him on the phone. He's just the cutest. He says to me in the cutest voice, 'Hi, Grandma.' It just gets me all teary-eyed. And after what seems like 2 hours sitting next to her, Gertrude seems to realize that perhaps she's talking a bit too much. You know, I feel terrible. Here I am just talking and talking without letting you get in a word in edgewise." And then Gertrude says, "Tell me, what do you think of my grandson?"
That's one of the worst ones I've heard. We got a little bit of smiles there, though. So we have somebody else on the phone. Somebody else just beeped in.
Yeah, this is Chris Edwards.
One more time?
Senator Edwards.
Oh, Senator Edwards. Welcome, Senator. Glad to have you on. Okay, Jim.
And now that the senator's on the phone, I'll try to do better later. So, as typical, we've loaded you up with materials, and some of them being very last minute, so you should have copies of what came out just yesterday evening. So we made hard copies of that today. And we sent you two rounds of communications we've received since your last meeting. I'd note that one of those was from Representative Helm on Washington Legislative District's flow of jobs and tax monies. Yeah. And I, Mr. Chair, that's about it. We'll be getting into scheduling details and all that later on in the agenda.
Okay, thanks. Somebody else just beeped in on the phone?
Yeah. Good morning, folks.
name of who beeped in?
It's James Nash. Good morning.
Oh, good.
Okay, James.
There you are, James. Yeah, but you cut out just a little bit there. How's things in Northeast Oregon this morning?
Oh, it's hot, but it's not smoky, so we're happy.
That's good. That's good. So I was talking to Claire this morning. She's going, she's going hiking in the Three Sisters.
Backpacking.
Rob's moving into a new condo. He's downsizing. Paul just got off the Salmon River from a float trip on the Salmon River, which we're all really jealous about. Anybody else want to share anything? Any trips or anything? And I was over in Sisters this weekend with grandchildren, so that was pretty fun for me. So, in terms of reporting, Jim and I had the privilege of testifying before the Fish and Wildlife Commission about a week ago to give them a preliminary report on where we were, and I'll let the chair of the commission give a report on how you think we did. Because we had a little bit of feedback. So.
No, I want to thank you for testifying. I think the snapshot, which is what we asked you to do, was well done. Obviously, from the questions, the allotted time went over, which was, that was good. I think we've all seen a presentation where someone, you know, testifies or says something and there is no interest, there are no questions. And you integrated the survey very well, which I thought was important for the commissioners. In fact, I've asked the director to actually delve into at one of our commission meetings a little deeper from the original survey and have the firm help us understand some of those feelings about Oregonians about fish and wildlife. So all in all, it was a good presentation, well received, very helpful. So thank you.
Good. We had several handouts. One of these, hopefully you've all seen that, that Roger put together. And then we had a the Task Force on Funding Fish and Wildlife. I call it the Q&A sheet. It's a series of questions and answers about what's this thing all about. So we provided that to the commission. So now let's go around the room and see if there's anybody else that has anything to report. We'd ask you not to report on anything related to your outreach yet, because we're going to cover that in detail. So anybody have anything that they would like to share with the rest of the task force members, at least at this point in time? Okay, so let's now move to the minutes. Alicia, another great job with you and Jim putting together the minutes. At least I thought they were great. So anybody have any comments on the minutes, any corrections or additions to the minutes as submitted? Okay, seeing none, we'll assume that those are approved then. So now let's move to a public comment. We ask you to identify yourself. I don't have a list of anybody who's signed up for public comments, but if anybody would like to provide public comment to the task force? Anybody want to provide public comment? Okay. We'll have another opportunity at the end. So now I'm going to turn it over to Jim. We're going to talk about the schedule, potential presentations, stakeholder groups. Jim's going to bring us up to speed first on the schedule. Task force member to share with what they've heard about the presentations on the outreach. Thank you all for your outreach, that you're reaching out to your various interest groups and others to get the meeting set up. Some of those meetings have already occurred, and some of them are yet to be set, or some of them are scheduled, and we've had yet to have those, but we've got several of those outreach meetings scheduled. And I just think it's so important that we reach out to these groups, because they're going to be the ones that are going to be testifying in front of the legislature about this proposal of whatever it's going to look like. And so we need to make sure that they are on a 1 to 10, at least a 10 on understanding it, what our proposal is going to be, and hopefully strong support for that when we get to the legislature. So this outreach, I think, is just hugely important. And we're making the time, Jim and I are making the time to try to attend as many of those as we can to provide input, but some of those are going to have to be done by you folks on your own. So, who would like to, anybody, let's start with you, Jim.
Sure, we sent a summary of the proposal out to our conservation and sportsman discussion group, this group I confer with as I come to this task force each time. I think you're familiar with that group. And in general, we also made a presentation to the board of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, which I specifically represent on this task force. In both cases, there was strong support for what the task force is doing. Whatever we settle on as the final funding strategy, we can count on this group being willing to testify and support very strongly. They appreciate the comprehensive nature of how long it's taken us and how much we considered to get here. Of the two proposals, by kind of a split decision, not unanimous, but a split decision, most people favor the tax surcharge over the bottle tax. But either way, whatever we settle on, we can count on them funding. They feel it's so important that we find a broad-based alternative funding for some of the general conservation work, because it's clear that the funding model that's leaning on hunters and fishing is not only inequitable, but it's just infeasible in the future. So we're going to end up with a major calamity down the road if this task force is not successful in finding a solution. Whatever we come up with, they will be there to testify for us unanimously amongst the group. And they favored the tax surcharge slightly over the bottle tax.
Any questions? Okay. Carrie, any follow-up? Okay. Brad, anything?
The Nature Conservancy is very connected to what we're doing. I've talked with staff extensively, and also have talked with a government affairs committee of the board. The board hasn't been meeting during the course of our work, so there will be a meeting of the board in September, and I expect to make a presentation to the board at that time. The committee and the staff
are quite receptive to what we're doing. They haven't seen the detail. Some of them have not seen the detail of the two alternatives for funding sources, but they're internally exploring ways to support our effort with additional polling as that becomes necessary to support a campaign of some type.
Questions, right? Okay, Paul?
Well, I presented the recommendations or where we're an update of this to the Oregon Hunters Association board on August 6th, and they were generally supportive of the income tax over the bottle fee idea. And then Wednesday of this week, we have a meeting scheduled with the Sport Group Leaders Council. It's I think there's like 150 people that are invited to that. Is that correct, Kevin? Something like that?
Yeah.
The mailing list for that. So we'll be having that meeting Wednesday evening at Fish and Wildlife Headquarters from 6 o'clock to or 6:30 to 8 o'clock. And Kevin's going to help me, and I believe Jim is going to be there as well to help with that. So hopefully we'll get a good turnout. It was kind of short notice to try to work it in, but we'll have that meeting on Wednesday, and we'll report back at the next session on that one.
Okay, thanks. Nancy, anything? Hey, Claire?
I'm still working on trying to get a meeting set up with city scientists, metro scientists for us. And I understand that there's going to be a joint state soil and water conservation district meeting and watershed council meeting in October. And so I'm going to try to make some contact there so we can get a slot on the agenda or some sort of breakout session to connect with those groups. And then I'll let Bruce talk about the meeting coming up later this month with the Oregon Conservation Network.
Nick?
So Kinji and I had a conversation with Lee Davis from Azamas, and he's totally willing to host a meeting in Portland that we could combine the outdoor industry and the nonprofit nonprofit representatives together. We just need to get a date. He's thinking a Friday afternoon would be best, so I wanted to check with you guys to see what Friday coming up might work best for you. If we can get like a week's notice, we can get the information out, and I think we've got a lot of interest for attendance. With the PDC's A&O committee, they haven't set a date yet, but the plan is to have a meeting in mid-September to mid-October. So we'll get a date from the PDC once that date's been set.
Bruce?
Yeah, I did the easy thing. I asked Adam Meyer of the Oregon Conservation Network to set something up, and he's been working with the staff here to do that. And it's a week from Friday, is that correct, at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife headquarters in South Salem down there. And for those who don't know it, the Oregon Conservation Network is effectively the legislative arm of the Oregon League of Conservation Voters. And I think it's safe to say it includes pretty much all the organizations in the conservation community that are actually engaged in state legislative activity, policy, those kind of things. And in general, I would say they've been pretty plugged into our process all the way along, but it's probably a good opportunity for those that haven't been to hear from those that have and to get a presentation on the full package.
And so those who may be watching on TV, I think it's at 10:30, isn't it, at ODF&W headquarters?
Yes.
So
10:30 on Friday, August
26th.
Thank you, Adam.
Okay. The Farm Bureau rep, I think I was talking to Marianne Nash, and you're having a board meeting in September, I think, and they were going to try to get me on the agenda for the Farm Bureau. So, yeah, so I just haven't seen the details of it yet, but I'll be more than happy to come, and Jim and I or me or whoever. So, okay, yes, Jim.
So one other one I want to mention, let me echo Mark's thanks for your efforts getting all this set up, and a reminder that we're looking at this in two rounds. We have this opportunity now between now and when we present preliminary recommendations in mid-September. So we're really trying to hit groups that represent multiple constituencies. And then we'll have an opportunity post that probably to do additional outreach. So one other group that's being set up is the External Budget Advisory Committee for ODF&W, and that's a very comprehensive set of folks. So that'll allow us to touch base in a lot of different places, and we're still working on getting that set up.
So Mike and Kenji, have you any outreach? And James?
So this is Kenji. Scott gave our report. We just participated in the conference call with the Mazama, so I have nothing to add to what he said.
Okay. Mike, anything to report? Must be listening in. So, you know, I see these outreach as two primary purposes. The one primary purpose for, I think, us is to educate, to take out the proposals, to talk to the various interest groups about what this is all about so that we can bring everybody up to speed, answer any questions that they might have. Well, why are you doing it this way? How come a dollar amount and a percentage amount? And why not 7 cents instead of, you know, all these questions that folks might have? So there's a really good opportunity to educate, but then also to see if we can get their support for a proposal that we might take forward. So it's two things from my perspective. One is to get people up to speed on where we are, get their feelings about it, whether they think it's a good idea or not, and then hopefully to get the support for eventually the package that we will be taking to the legislature. So, okay, Jim.
Kind of along those same lines of educate and inform and gain support, there's going to be a certain point at which we're going to have a major media strategy. And up until now, we've been trying to keep all media inquiries going directly through you and Jim and kind of keep it kind of quiet on the media side as we do our constituency networking work. But at some point, we're going to have to try to inform the broader public, and the only way you reach the broader public is through the media. So I think it's very important for us to think about, is it important to have some kind of a media strategy, you know, meetings with the editorial boards of the major newspapers, for example, some TV coverage about what the problem is and why this is the right solution. The strategic question is, do we do that before or after our presentation to the legislature, and what will be the kind of the organizational strategy to do this and do this effectively? I know the Blue Ribbon Panel has been working this year after the release. The National Blue Ribbon Panel has been working to try to reach the New York Times and the major non-endemic media to try to basically express the same question and solution presentation nationally. So we need to think sometime or another about what will be the best time and what our strategy will be for trying to reach the general public.
You got an idea?
I think letting people know before the presentation of the legislature about what our general thinking is, and then allowing us to react to what the legislature says and does as going into the fall. Kind of, I don't think one presentation is what we need. I think we need a series of updates and reactions and listen to what their editorializing and what the letters to the editor and things like that are saying about this in general. So I think we need an outreach strategy all the way till the legislature starts and then going into the legislative session. And I would suggest sooner rather than later. So, you know, in my experience, setting up meetings with editorial boards takes quite a while. So I would start reaching to them. Now, I know there may be some other people who think, well, we wouldn't be sufficiently respectful to the legislature if we went to media before we made our presentation to them. And if that were the thought of the group, I'm fine with that. That's not that far off. But it's something we haven't talked very much about. I think it's something that's going to be critical to the campaign, and we need to really put our thinking caps on about how to reach the general public with this is the problem. This is what we've heard from the survey. This is what the problem is. This is what we think the solution is. And this is our reaction to the naysayers who say, no, it's not going to politically fly.
Anybody else have any thoughts on it?
I think that the general public probably isn't aware that this task force was put together. I think you might want to start out basically that this task force was asked for by the legislature. I think you want to start out with that. So this has come out of some nowhere. It came out of legislature's direction, and I think it'd be give kind of context to it.
So that would be an argument for waiting till after the legislative presentation before we reach out?
I would defer maybe to the legislators here in the room, maybe what they think. I agree with you that that's kind of dicey in the sense that you want to piss people off before. I would defer on that one.
We're going to talk about this later too, about how we, you know, the next steps. But yeah. Jim, do you have a comment?
So appreciate your raising that issue. Staff's very sensitive about the protocols here. We are a legislative task force reporting to the legislature. And unless we got a green light from our ex officio members here to meet with the press prior to our reporting, we'd be very concerned about that. I think it's valuable to do, but we think it's always also valuable to make sure that we respect the legislative process and get some feedback, because if we're told that we're dead in the water by the two committees we're going to report to, that leaves us in a different place. But it would be good to hear from our ex officio members.
Senator Edwards?
So one of those members has a question.
Go ahead.
So I could hear most of what was said, but I could not hear what body or group it is that you're contemplating presenting to before or after the legislature.
The media.
Yeah, it's a...
Oh, got it. Okay.
Particularly editorial boards.
And Jim is lobbying strong... Well, Jim Owens is lobbying strongly that we get direction from our legislative folks that are here today about the timing and process. So we're asking that question of you, legislators that are here today, your thoughts. So, Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Lapper, I was reading through the preliminary framework recommendations as really taken aback on page 11, where the second charge of the legislature has just been ignored. What does it actually say? Task force notes that significant program adjustments represent policy decisions that are the responsibility of the legislature. Line item budget adjustments to ODF&W programs are considered to be beyond the scope of the task force assignment. But is this task force just punting one of the three charges back to the legislature? And I don't think that's going to fly well with the legislature. One of the charges of this group was to evaluate the current programs, the overlap, the redundancies, the effectiveness of the programs in the current budget. We haven't done that. At least I have been missing. And. I don't even know when the task force, I'm not a voting member, but maybe I was sleeping when the task force voted on that, but I don't remember that happening. So I'm questioning how much credibility the task force will have if they just simply eliminate one of the three charges and say, well, this is your job.
Okay. Do you have an opinion on the strategy of when we go public, when we don't go public? Should it be before the legislative presentation, the end of September, or after?
I believe that make your pitch to the legislature, obtain the legislator's feedback as to what they agree with, what they don't agree with, what else needs to be done before you go to the public, because I think many legislators will be a little bit put off by being lobbied on something that isn't completed yet.
Okay, thank you. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I made just a couple of observations. The first is we just passed a piece of legislation in the 2016 session that increased the renewable portfolio standard by another 25%. It's the biggest leap forward for posit toward renewable energy incentives that the state's made in many, many years. That effort almost foundered because of the approach of the advocates, which was they got into a room and agreed that this was wonderful and came with a fully formed package to the legislature and the Public Utilities Commission. And there were a lot of members that said, boy, that looks like a good thing, but why didn't you come talk to us first? That's kind of our job. I don't think you want to go down that path quite, so be careful there. The other observation I'd make is, you know, this is, our meetings have been public all along. We cannot control what's going to go on social media at all. And this, you know, whatever goes on as we approach the legislative session isn't going to be as dependent on editorial boards, I don't think, as it is social media. So, you know, for the folks that want to tell their own groups that they're affiliated with about what's going on and what they think, that's going to happen whether we say anything about it or not. And I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think it'd be great to have constituents simply contacting their legislators without any idea of what the solution is, saying, we know that this task force has been going on and we really value wildlife for all of it and fish and wildlife for all of its multiple values, and we want you to do something about it because you've been meeting to try to do that. Go ahead.
Okay. Senator Edwards, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah. I was just about to say that I didn't think that it mattered as much as people might be concerned about, but then I think Representative Howell brought up some good points, and different legislators will have different levels of feeling about the task force getting out in front of the legislature if they start going to the media and, you know, meeting with editorial boards and whatnot. I'm just, you know, one additional observation is that I think that there's a fair chance that whatever the legislative exchange is in committee becomes, it helps frame the discussion for the media. And so if that doesn't go well, then, the media will be able, will be certainly watching that. And could be, printing that, publishing that, and of course you have a second shot with editorial boards. But so I just, just something to think about that, however that committee hearing goes. I think we heard a little bit of it today. Senator Whitsitt expressed some concerns. So you can imagine, Senator Whitsitt is on my committee. If we have a hearing, I'm sure that he will be forthcoming with his opinions about this, and that will be certainly a part of the media story. So just food for thought. I do think it's probably better to go to the legislature first, or at least be members of the legislature, even if it's not in a full committee hearing, but brief members of the legislature that have a particular interest in ODF&W issues. I know it's really important to everybody on this task force, but I can assure you that ODF&W issues are not the most important issues to all 90 members of the legislature, but there certainly are, a handful of members that are more actively engaged with those issues, and at least getting to them with the outcomes of the report, I think would be good prior to going to the meeting or going to the media.
Okay, so here's what I'm hearing: our legislators that are here today, the direction is that when we come up with our preliminary recommendations that we're going to take to the legislature, that we will do that. We will not go to the press before then. We'll get that advice and counsel from the legislature on where we are with our preliminary recommendations. They'll tell us which way they want us to go, and then hopefully we'll have time between then and February before the session gets in to craft the direction that they would like us to go. So, Jim?
I agree with that. I think we should be respectful for the good advice we've gotten. However, that does not prevent us from planning our media strategy between now and then. So once that legislative presentation has been made, then I think basically having a well-organized strategy to let the general public know what's going on here is important. We can do some lead time on planning.
Yep, and we've been really clear all the way along that we don't have a recommendation yet. It's all preliminary. The task force hasn't decided on the final recommendation, so everything's real preliminary. So, Senator Whitsitt, I don't want to lose track of your advice and counsel, and so we need to discuss that later in the day about task force number two, our charge number two. I think we need to have some discussion as a task force on that, so I don't want to put that off. So we definitely need to have that discussion, because I know it is a high priority for you that we have not addressed that. So don't want to leave that on the table. Okay. So yes, Paul.
A question to Jim's point about having a strategy for after we report to the legislature. This body, if I'm not mistaken, probably goes away after our report to the legislature.
Well, we're going to discuss that.
Okay.
I thought it did too, but Jim's going, well, you might want to hang around a little bit.
Well, I didn't know if we had a shelf life after that report.
Originally, our shelf life was we were done when we reported to the legislature, but now there's some discussion about we're probably going to get some direction from the legislature, and we may want to continue before we get to the final session and help craft what the legislative direction is, if that's what the legislature wants us to do. So,
if they want it, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So.
Very good.
It seems like the door never closes on task forces. Did I capture that correctly, Jim?
Yeah, so there really isn't a sunset clause to the legislation. We have a report date, and we envision that just as the chair indicated, we may need to do additional work on our recommendations based upon the legislative feedback. So how much time that takes and the nature of that is premature to guesstimate at this point.
Yeah. Stand by.
Yep, stand by.
Time service.
Okay, so now let's, I think we're ready to move into Maureen's presentation. This is going to be a intimate, detailed presentation. Now, as you recall, at our July 27th meeting, we had some conversation with Legislative Council on the questions about the income tax surcharge as one of our alternate funding sources, and we asked for some further research. We're drilling deeper and deeper into this. You should have all received the formal analysis from Legislative Council dated August 12th. And that included the legality of the four options identified on the income tax surcharge. Maureen is here today. Thank you, Maureen, to summarize that analysis for us and then take questions as we go along on that analysis. So if you pull out the document, hopefully you have the blue document that talks about the options. And then we have a legislative council committee letter that you should have also received that'll help with frame the discussion. So, Maureen, it's all yours. Welcome.
Okay, thank you very much. Hi, everyone. My name is Maureen McGee. I'm deputy legislative counsel. You wouldn't usually see me sitting here talking about taxes. Last time you met, you spoke with Kate Toswell, and she's she's the tax drafter within Ledge Council. She was unable to make it today. And since I do the drafting for ODFW and am familiar with this task force and the issues, I happily offer to fill in for her. So what I'm going to do is just start out by actually walking through the opinion. I think it'll be helpful to just talk through that whole analysis for those of you that may have not had time to read it fully. And I'll do my best to answer any questions that you have coming out of that analysis. So what Kate was charged with doing after the last task force meeting was looking a little bit more in detail at the tax surcharge options that are before the task force. Three of those impose a surcharge and a flat amount, and the fourth would require adding an additional percentage to a taxpayer's tax liability onto their income taxes. And as you have read in the opinion, Kate determined that the first three of those options would likely be unconstitutional absent certain provisions. The surtax, the fourth option, which is the proportional surtax, could be constitutional as long as a non-resident surtax liability was fairly apportioned. So the first important issue that we need to look at whenever looking at these kind of charges is whether it's going to be a tax or a fee. Any one of the tax or charges that you're looking at would be considered a tax for purposes of the Oregon Constitution. And that's because it would be money paid into, be a charge where there's not some form of equivalent exchange of value in the exchange for the charge, and that uses revenue for the charge for general government purposes. So you pay your income taxes to the government uses that money for general government purposes like fixing your roads and funding firefighters, that's a tax. Similarly here, a taxpayer would not have the option to forego paying any of the surcharge surcharges that are proposed. And they would not receive a direct benefit in return other than good government. The benefit the taxpayer would receive would be conservation of wildlife or habitat, and that's comparable to other general benefits of good government, such as roads, public safety, fire, that sort of thing. So the surcharge would be viewed as a tax, and under the Oregon Constitution, that means that it would need to, any bill to impose a surcharge would need to originate in the House, and it would need to receive a three-fifths majority of votes cast in both chambers. So that's kind of preliminary discussion of just how this would need to move through the legislature. The next question that we need to look at is whether or not the flat fees would be considered a poll or head tax. So the Oregon Constitution has a provision that no poll or head tax shall be levied or collected in Oregon. There was a very recent opinion coming out of the Court of Appeals asking whether or not the Portland Arts Tax violated this provision, and the Court of Appeals concluded that it did not because the arts tax has exemptions for low-income taxpayers. And when you look at the legislative history of that constitutional provision, it was clear that at the time the voters voted to put that provision into the Constitution, they were looking at flat taxes that had no exemption based on a taxpayer's financial resources. So if you have a flat tax, but it does have provisions accounting for low-income folks, the current jurisprudence out of the Court of Appeals is that that would not violate the prohibition against poll or head taxes under the Oregon Constitution. So applying that to the options that you have before you right now, options one through three all focus on a flat tax. The option number two, I believe, is the one that would contain an exemption for low-income taxpayers as well as ODFW license and permit holders. And so that particular option would likely be constitutional under the poll or head tax provision because you do have some exemption for low-income folks under that option.
So I just want to clarify, option two does that?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, okay, I thought I heard you say three. Okay, so
option two.
Option two,
mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Options one and three do not include exemptions for low-income taxpayers, and so they would come up against problems under the poll or head tax analysis.
So clearly option one and three, if I read this correctly, Maureen, I just want to hear you say it verbally. Option one and three are dead.
Option
much.
One and three would be considered unconstitutional,
yeah,
poll or head taxes because they do not have provisions accounting for exemptions for low-income taxpayers.
Okay. Yes, Jim?
And option one or three also, one of those options is the tax on containers on bottles?
No, we're just dealing with the income tax surcharge right now.
We'll, I haven't memorized which options are numbered,
that sheet in front of you by any chance?
Got it.
That's the one we're working on right now. So if you just cross option off four, one and three, cross those off,
gotcha.
They're unconstitutional. Yes.
Okay, thank
Carrie.
You.
But my understanding is that option two would also require some language around non-resident income in order to work, according to the written memo. Does that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I haven't gotten to that part of the memo yet. So right now we're just looking at the constitutional provision dealing with polar head taxes.
Great.
So just dealing with the polar head tax issue, option two would be the option that would be in compliance with that provision of the Oregon Constitution. So then the next issue that we look at is the non-resident issue. And we look at taxation on non-residents under a Commerce Clause analysis. The Commerce Clause is a provision of the United States Constitution, which grants Congress the authority to regulate commerce among the several states. And that language actually contains a negative implication that's known as the Dormant Commerce Clause. It prohibits states from discriminating against or burdening interstate commerce. And so when we're dealing with taxation of non-residents, which here we would be looking at a income taxation of non-residents, we have to look at whether or not that income taxation would burden interstate commerce in any way such that it would violate the Dormant Commerce Clause. The Supreme Court has a test for determining how that would work. It has a number of factors. It looks at whether or not the taxation is applied to an activity with a substantial nexus to the taxing state. And so the reason that we can tax non-resident income earners at all is because we're only taxing the income that they earn in the state. That's the substantial nexus. So that's one factor. You also have to look at whether or not the taxation is fairly apportioned. You have to look at whether it discriminates against interstate commerce, and you have to look at whether it's fairly related to the services that are provided by the state. So what we are dealing with the options before us is really the apportionment issue. If the surcharge were to be done as a flat tax, and that flat tax applied equally to in-state income earners and out-of-state income earners, it would likely be considered not fairly apportioned because the out-of-state income earners would not be paying a portion that is equivalent to the portion that the in-state income earners, they'd essentially be paying kind of at a higher percentage. And so that would be considered not fairly apportioned and would likely also get into the discrimination against interstate commerce analysis. So in order to make sure that there isn't a Dormant Commerce Clause violation with taxing the non-resident income earners, the surcharge, whether it's done as the flat rate or done as under option four, which was presented here as just adding an additional percentage of liability, would need to be apportioned for out-of-state income earners. And we do apportion taxes for out-of-state income earners already in other contexts, just the standard way that personal income taxes are calculated for out-of-state income earners is apportioned under a ratio. And that's also true for part-time income earners, people that only lived in Oregon for 6 months during the tax year before they moved to California or something. So if the surcharges were apportioned, and you could use the apportionment ratio that's already applicable to taxpayers under other statutes. So that's for the flat tax. If you apportion the flat tax for out-of-state folks, or if you went with option four and made sure that the option four amount that the out-of-state income earners were paying was calculated after the standard apportionment that already applies to their income tax, then it should be compliant with the Dormant Commerce Clause question.
We just need to make sure we have that wording if that's one of the ones chosen. The wording about if applied for out-of-state filers.
For the out-of-state filers, it would need to be fairly apportioned.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then option two would be okay.
So yes. So at the end of the day, option two, as long as the flat tax were multiplied by an apportionment ratio, or option four,
mm-hmm.
would likely be the options that have the best legal
chance.
Grounding. Yeah.
Okay. And I'm not a tax attorney, so that's why I'm asking the straight questions. So. Okay. Yes, Rob.
Thank you. I think that's really clear and very straightforward. The one question I have, it may be a moot question, but perhaps not given Merrill Radish's communication between meetings. In looking at option two, I think you've answered it clearly with respect to the provision as it currently stands, which is to exempt license holders and low-income filers. If that were modified to exempt low-income filers and not license holders, would that affect the constitutionality under the Oregon Constitution? I assume it would not, because the low-income filing exemption would be sufficient to meet the test of the case.
Yes, I believe you're correct, because what the constitutional provision has been interpreted to require is some provision for low-income taxpayers, some exemption for low-income taxpayers. So as long as that's present, it would seem to be in compliance with the Court of Appeals' recent opinion.
So that might lead to an option 2A, where we have option 2 would be to exempt low-income filers, option 2 would be to license holders and low-income filers, option 2A would be just to exempt low-income filers.
I'm not advocating that. I just wanted clarity about the constitutionality of doing that.
Yeah, but could be an option.
Yeah, so the low-income filers exemption is the part that you need to avoid the poll tax argument.
Okay. Any other guests? Yes, Mike.
Follow up on that in just a little bit of more depth. It seems to me by having license holders, which is a fee, exempted from a tax, which is meant to apply to every Oregon citizen, we're mixing apples and oranges. So, in other words, we're exchanging a tax exemption benefit in exchange for a fee paid for the taking of fish and wildlife. So you have two unequal classes. You have those who are paying across the board this tax surcharge, and then someone who pays a fee for the taking of a public resource is exempt from the tax. That's the question.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question that might require some further thought. Since I don't do the tax drafting, I can't think off the top of my head if we have other tax exemptions in place that are similar to that. But that could be an interesting question to look into.
Equal application of the law, I think. So anyway.
Yes, Jim?
So regarding the Commerce Clause provision, my understanding of your advice is that for out-of-state filers who get part of their income in Oregon but live elsewhere, we would have to have some kind of proportionality. That's not necessarily true of the in-state people. So you could theoretically have a hybrid. You could either have some kind of proportionality for everybody, substitute a percentage like 1%, or what you could do is have the flat fee for the in-state people, and then for anybody who's out of state, have some kind of proportionality.
Yeah, I believe that what Kate was suggesting in the opinion, if you went with the flat surcharge, is you'd have the flat fee for in-state taxpayers, and then for out-of-state taxpayers, that flat fee would be multiplied against the same ratio that all the rest of their out-of-state taxes would be multiplied against to come up with a proportionate fee.
I see.
For the out-of-state folks.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else before we have further discussion?
Happy to answer any other questions.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, clear as mud? No, I think we're getting it narrowed down.
Clear.
Okay, thank you, Maureen. I want to particularly thank Representative Helm because you asked for the legislative, the only way we can get answers from legislative council is for a representative to ask those questions. So thank you for doing that. And
Kate for actually writing the opinion and doing the research.
So thank you very much. Okay, so
we're on this
No, go ahead. Exemption. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. We have legislative research here also.
Legislative revenue.
I'm sorry? Legislative revenue. Okay.
At the last meeting, there were a number of questions about the low-income exemption and how that would work. So if there are still those questions, I wanted to make sure somebody was here who could answer them. Maybe everyone's clear now.
Well, let's go ahead and summarize for us, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Good morning. Chris Allenack from the Legislative Revenue Office, sitting in for Christine Broniak, who's been doing the work on this. And as Beth described, it was just there were some questions, I guess, around the definition of low income or how it might connect with the earned income tax credit and so forth. And I can do my best to answer questions. I've had conversations with Christine about different ways to come up with the estimates and some of the policy options. I don't know specifically the precise parameters or levers used to come up with the estimates, but I can certainly do my best to talk about them conceptually if there are outstanding questions.
So I think, as you recall, the definition that we use for adjusted gross income for low income was $20,000. So could you explain that? Is that how that was derived?
I think part of the conversations I had, Christine, was there was a stated revenue need with a desire to exempt a certain level of income. So with a couple of those parameters, you can arrive at a rough annual estimate of how much revenue could be raised by if the fee slash tax is set at a certain dollar amount and you exempt income below a level. It just becomes a math thing, so to speak, about how the estimates come out. I don't know that there's anything magical about $20,000. AGI, for the most part, I mean, it's your typical taxable income. It's your wages is the biggest piece of that. AGI will include things like retirement income. Now, you can get into some nuances here. You have federal AGI includes taxable Social Security income. But if you're talking about a concept of Oregon AGI, then it includes no Social Security income because Oregon, as per the Constitution, is not allowed to tax Social Security income. Other forms of retirement income are included in that pot.
So the question I think that I heard was, how did you come up with that $20,000 figure? So that was the process that we used was, okay, where did you get that? So we got that from staff that was the adjusted gross income figure of $20,000 that included those parameters.
I believe so, to arrive at the need for the revenue source, the amount of revenue that the task force is looking at.
Okay. Rob?
Well, I believe Tricia asked the question and was concerned whether this was a $20,000 exemption or an earned income tax credit exemption, and it wasn't clear to her that it was the earned income tax credit. Someone gave the answer that yes, it was. I think you may have done that, Beth. And so that's the clarification she was seeking.
Is that correct?
So in that case, one of the things Christine and I did talk about was a test to decide the exemption is that if a taxpayer were eligible and claimed the EIC, then they would be exempt from the fee that you're referring to. And so that is something that could be done pretty straightforwardly from the tax return. It's kind of a yes or no situation. Did the taxpayer claim the either federal or Oregon EIC, and if yes, then they're exempt from this. If the answer is no, then they would have to pay it. Now, the federal EIC and Oregon mirrors the federal EIC. It's a tax credit that, starting from a zero-based income and then increasing income, the amount of the EIC increases over a period, over a stretch of income, and then it's flat for a level of income and then phases out for a period of income. So there are a couple of possibilities there for determining the yes-no, kind of the litmus test respect. But the most straightforward one is, did the taxpayer claim the EIC? If yes, then they are exempt from this. And if the answer is no, then they would be subject to it.
Okay. I see heads nodding yes, sir. Any?
I am with me.
Okay. Bruce?
Just to further clarify then, so the earned income, the $20,000 is just rather an arbitrary number that was picked for revenue calculations. It's not based on the earned income, if everybody who took the earned income credit.
Correct. The earned income tax credit, the calculation is more complicated than that.
Okay. Seeing no questions, no questions on the phone? Nope, sorry, Scott.
How does it differ from what the Portland Art Tax does in terms of qualification of a low income? And is it, would it make sense to follow their lead in, since they figured this out already?
Not sure I'm familiar with all of the nuances of the Portland Arts Tax. I don't know if that's per, I believe it's $35.
And Maureen's left, so.
We can investigate that.
Okay.
I think we understood it was the same.
Okay.
But we'll check that out.
Your point is make sure that we're aligned with that.
Yeah,
so
that's already gone through and it's already been vetted, right, and it's already been talked about and people understand it, and let's not introduce a whole new concept if
yep.
we don't have to.
Gotcha. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, sir. So I was thinking we would go now to discuss the bottle on the second page and then come back and summarize. So I'm going to try this one more time just to see if it's got legs or not. And this is a little difficult for me because I actually support this one. So, but the group said not to. But you remember at our July 27th meeting, we voted to eliminate the unredeemed deposit options for further consideration. However, since that meeting, we've heard from task force members, and I understand Kenji has a similar concern or a similar comment to make, and some of our constituent groups that alternative should stay on the table. So in the spirit of iterative decision-making process, I'd like to open the discussion one more time. And so I'm going to just make my point, and then if Kenji wants to weigh in, and if we want to eliminate it, we can sure eliminate it. We've since we started, remember, it was a 5%, or excuse me, 5 cents, and then as a result of the legislation, it's going to 10 cents now, and that will go into effect in 2009. When's it going to effect? 2 years from now, right?
2017.
It goes to 10 cents. So I'm not going to get the figures exactly right, but it was like an unredeemed 68% or something like that was unredeemable. So the bottling or the manufacturers would use that money to pay for the facilities that collect. So now it's going to go from 5 to 10. So the unredeemable will likely increase as a result of people saying, 10 cents. I'm not going to throw that away anymore. I'm going to turn that in. So the thinking is based upon, I think it's Michigan, right? Michigan was up in the high 80s, 90% range. It was pretty high that was redeemable or unredeemable. So that there's a small amount there. So we heard from the Oregon Beverage and Recycling folks. Are they here today? Okay. So we heard from the Oregon Beverage and Recycling folks that we're going to use all that. That's going to be the money that we're going to have to use because our recycling rates are going to go up, and so there's not going to be any money. But we don't have access to their budget. We don't have – it's not available to us. So we don't know whether that additional money, if there is something there. And I personally see a nexus in potentially this being able to fund fish and wildlife. So the question is, do we want the legislature to ask the Oregon Beverage and Recycling folks through a legislative process, is this something that is available? Is there any flexibility in your budget to provide some of this funding to fund Oregon's fish and wildlife and conservation folks? Or is it's all gone, we need every bit of it, it's not there? And the thinking is it's difficult to get a tax. We all know that. But if the money's already there and there is some flexibility in there, is there an opportunity for us to say, you know, this is good for all of Oregon and good for the citizens of Oregon? And is there enough money to be able to adequately fund some things? That's the big question is, are we just talking, you know, few million dollars, or are we talking a fairly significant amount of dollars? So, Kenji, I understand you also have that same, you'd like to weigh in on it. Is that correct or not?
Mark, this is Kenji. On the unredeemed, not really. The one that that I'm sort of a proponent of is the 1% tax on the bottled beverages subject to, or bottled beverages subject to the deposit law. So I'm sort of ambivalent on the unredeemed, so I really don't take a stance on that,
okay.
That side.
Okay.
So I think there was an issue where it might have been misconstrued, but I'm ambivalent about the unredeemed deposits.
Okay, I heard that you had an opinion on that. So, Rob, and then Jim.
Well, I think it was clear in our last meeting that a very small portion of the additional nickel would be available, so we're not really solving the problem at the financial level. We want to solve it if we attack that. We also heard from Representative Helm that further exploration of this is a fatal flaw in the legislative process. So I think we're wasting our time looking at this both from a practical perspective and from the perspective of the criteria we have for fundraising or for funding the agency's needs, and there simply isn't sufficient revenue here to justify going forward.
Okay, thank you. Jim?
I agree completely with what Rob said. I would have said exactly the same thing, and I'd add to that I think it's a strategic mistake to go to the legislature with two options. I think it's more important to go to the legislature with one option. I think the task force ought to try to boil this down based on what we've heard from the constituents to what our primary option is. Obviously, if we get to the legislature and they say this is dead, then every other option opens back up to them, and we can make them aware of all the other options we looked at and what the advantages and disadvantages were. But it just seems to me that it's a mistake to try to gore somebody else's ox to try to get this problem solved. And this is clearly going to be perceived as goring the beverage industry's ox. And we're going to end up with more opposition than we end up with in favor. So I agree with Rob. If we have to vote one more time, I guess we have to vote one more time. Let's just show our red card, put this to bed, and move on.
Okay, I see heads nodding.
Just to clarify, Mark, I think, are we talking about two different issues here? Because I thought that we sort of disposed of the unredeemed deposits, but we had narrowed it down to, say, the 1% or 2% tax on the beverages subject to the bottle bill. So I think we might be talking apples and oranges here. One other piece that I want to add real quick about the 1% is I think in downturns of the economy, it's going to be fairly stable. So I just want to make that note when in comparison to income tax, but if it's a percentage. But I just want to clarify what exactly what part we're talking about in terms of the bottle deposits.
Well, we're looking at option one, which was the going to 10 cents. It brings in $52 million a year at an 84% redemption rate. That's our estimate. So that's – and what I'm hearing is
– Per biennium.
Per biennium. Excuse me, per biennium. And so what I'm hearing around the room is no. Correct? Okay. I'm seeing for the folks on the phone, I'm seeing head nods that say yes, where this is dead, we're not moving on. So now let's go to option two, beverage container tax.
Okay.
So that's we've all got that in front of us. Of the 1 cent on each water bottle would be $5.8 million per biennium. 1 cent on beverage container subject to the deposit law is $32.8 million. I mean, this is an additional tax now, folks. And 2.5 cents would be $82 million per biennium, and that's a straight fee. The percentage, 1% on beverage containers subject to deposit would bring in about $40 million per biennium. 3% would bring in $118 million per biennium. And these are, again, just our best guess estimates based upon what we've been able to garner. So discussion on that. Okay, Jim?
Mr. Chair, part of the conversation was looking at a couple options here. One is the charge per beverage container and ensuring that if we were moving that forward as a proposal, it was adequate to meet the identified funding needs. So that was the 2.5 cents. So that was an option that seemed to have legs still. The 1%, conversation on that was, again, in order to meet the funding objectives, it's got to be at least 85 million. And Brett brought up the opportunity, if you raised it to 3%, that represents an opportunity to deal with some other budget challenges in the natural resource arena. He specifically mentioned the Elliott State Forest challenge there, and he said so there was somewhat of a pitch, if you will, for looking at a higher percentage if you went a percentage route. So I think at this point, I think we would, as staff, we would lobby for keeping two options on the table, just like there's two options on the table for the surcharge, a flat and a percentage.
Comments? Yes, Senator Whitsitt? And then Rob.
Brought to my attention that that the public schools use a lot of bottled water. Originally, they were shifting away, trying to shift students away from soft drinks, so they were using more and more bottled water. Now, with the potential lead scare in some of the waters, which I think is probably greatly overstated, but nonetheless, the schools are using more of that. So we might be, the task force might want to consider what the cost to the schools, of a penny a bottle. I don't know whether that's huge or not, but there's about 600,000 students in the public school system. So a bottle a day apiece would be $6,000 a day, something like that. So something to think about.
And I just heard the other day, I don't know if it's factual or not, but we've actually changed now where there's more people using bottled water than soft drinks now. It used to be that if soft drinks were at some level, and now bottled water has exceeded that. So we're making a shift out of getting away from soft drinks. So Rob, and then Carrie, and then Jim.
We heard in our first task force meeting, and we've heard periodically since then, that the natural resource needs go well beyond ODF&W in this state. And so I'm personally receptive to a broader tax, but that's not what this task force was asked to do. And we haven't really looked at anything beyond ODF&W and its needs. I have knowledge that the Oregon Department of Forestry has natural resource funding needs, and other agencies do as well. But that's a legislative decision. And if the legislature wants to look at a broader funding source to address more than the issues we were asked to address, then I'd invite them to do that. So when we start looking at 3% to produce substantially more than ODF&W needs at $119 million per biennium, I think we shouldn't go there as this task force, and leave that to the legislature to look at. I think if we go to the legislature with two open possibilities, one being a beverage container tax and the other being a surcharge, the legislature can pursue that avenue if they want to, if they choose to.
Okay, so let's close the loop on that. What everybody's thoughts on that? You agree?
I agree with Bob, Rob.
Okay, so we're in agreement then. We're not proposing any for other natural resource agencies then. Harry, and then Jim?
I have a couple of questions. The first is, I'm reading this beverage container tax, this is a tax at the wholesale level, right? Not the retail level. Okay, so that's how I'm reading it. My other question is with regards to this, as well as the revenues estimated on option four that exceed the $80 to $85 million that we've identified. My question is, when I go back into the ODF&W budget, it looks like the general fund monies allocated to ODF&W are around $62 million per biennium. Does that sound right? No.
No, Mr. Chair and Gary, in our current budget, this current biennium, we have, I believe it's $30.5 million. That's the biennial total.
Okay. So my question is, in the committee correspondence, somebody raised the flag about general fund monies potentially being at risk under these scenarios. And so I'm just sort of putting that out there because it isn't that could be the case. And my question is, a couple of these scenarios would cover the loss of that general fund money. And so that's just something for us to keep in mind. And then as a follow-up, if we are not exempting hunting and license fee holders, which we've talked about quite a lot as a task force in these different scenarios around the surcharges, I'm just curious as to whether in some of these larger revenue generating opportunities, we can handle the risk of losing the general fund and perhaps reduce the hunting and fee license amounts if we're not able to exempt them or we choose not to exempt them and still come out okay financially for the agency, releasing some funds to the legislature from the general fund allocation that they might apply to some of these other uses that we've agreed we can't solve, but make sure that we're sort of keeping the end in mind about potential scenarios of losing the general fund money and wanting to create more equity for hunters and fishermen so that they're not overpaying as they are currently. They're covering more than just hunting and fishing, and we're trying to equalize that. So that's kind of convoluted, but it looks like there is an opportunity to protect the agency against potential general fund losses and provide some equity to hunters and fishermen if they're not exempted from the surcharge scenario. And I just want to kind of toss that out there and make sure I'm thinking that through correctly in your opinion.
So if I can summarize what I thought I heard you say, go big or go home. Because if we go big, they're going to sweep the general fund, take it out, so there better be enough money to backfill.
Well, and if we go big, and they do, we're okay still.
Yeah.
And I'm just asking that question, are we okay? Or is there inherent volatility that worries us about losing a general fund scenario? I mean, we have seen that happen in the past when we started funding parks out of lottery, the general fund money went away, just as whoever wrote that comment and noted. In this scenario, that may be okay. It may even be something that we proactively take in and say, here's a solution to our problem, plus you get $31 million in general fund back to apply to other needs.
So, we need $6 million per biennium for status quo. We need $21.2 million per biennium for deferred maintenance, or status quo deferred maintenance and unfunded mandates. For funding the mission, we need $76.3 million per biennium, and that includes the branding and the marketing of $10.5 million. So, Jim?
Well, I agree with Kerry. I think we need to have our options in our sleeve, but I don't think the right idea is to go to the legislature and say, we're anticipating you're going to take this $30 million general fund back, and therefore we're going to pad it. I think the way to do it is to have a nice, tight proposal. Then if in the legislature they propose to take the general fund away, we say, okay, as a task force, we just want you to know we considered this. If you do that, we're either not going to adequately fund the conservation job or we're going to have to increase the income surcharge or the bottle percentage. So, yes, the flexibility is there to cover that. The question is how you present it to the legislature. I would prefer to go with them with a nice, tight proposal. The same logic why we didn't have a bunch of deal sweeteners on making hunting and fishing better. We tightened that up in our task force because we wanted to have a fully justified proposal here. So that's my reaction to Kerry. with regard to what I originally raised my hand for, I just think it's a smart move to go in there with one proposal rather than two. And then, and I would prefer, I mean, based on the feedback we got from our group that we reached out to, that the tax proposal is the best one.
Okay, Rob?
I'm aligned with Jim on this. The other thing I would say is we can't anticipate all the alternative decisions the legislature might make. It's not a binary choice between keeping 30.5 million and deleting 35.5 million. There's a whole scale, and so I think, and so I think we can't anticipate all those alternatives, and we should have a single proposal.
A single proposal on the bottles, or are you saying a single proposal on?
I think we have made the assumption that there's going to be a continuation of the general fund at its current level, and I think we need to continue with that assumption and not make varying assumptions as to what the alternatives are.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Bruce and then Senator Whitsitt.
Yeah, I have all along thought that we should have one proposal. You know, I've actually come back around a little bit. The important thing to me is that we don't give them proposals that won't do the job on their own. We have two options here, either one of which would do that. And when you go back to look at our charge, they didn't tell us to kind of, we didn't have to come up with a precise prescription. We're supposed to come up with funding sources and identify the needs. And I think we're doing that there. So I'm actually, I can go either way. I would prefer to have one proposal, and I tend to support the income tax surcharge. The other thing I would say about it, we have been talking for shorthand purposes, I think, about an exemption for low income and for license purchasers. And technically, maybe that becomes a credit, a tax credit, which might get around the issue I think that Mike was raising. We give people tax credits for political contributions. You know, it's not tied to income or anything like that. You could have a tax credit here that would offset the surcharge.
Okay. Senator.
Thank you. Looking at this agency requested budget dated June 6, 10, 9th and 10th, 2016, the ODF&W is asking for an additional $68 million for the next biennium, which is about a 19% increase. But they're not asking for $30 million. They're asking for an additional $28.5 million from general fund. So those are they're additive. They're looking for more like 58. And then also about $21 million of that, or $18 million of that increase is from your frugality in carrying forward $41 million. And that's a one-time funding, I'm assuming. Because if you saved it last year, you're going to spend it this year, and then it's not available anymore. So what I'm saying is that we're not just talking about a $30 million sustained general fund budget hole. We're looking at, you're asking for a lot more general fund, plus there's another $18 million that is a one-time fund.
Okay, and I see Director Meltzer nodding yes, so.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that those are, that increase that Senator Witz is referring to our policy option packages that we've and the commission has authorized that we're proposing. Many of them are redundant to the things that this task force has been advocating for. You know, there's a package in there that's Oregon Conservation Strategy Implementation. There's a package in there that's Pacific Fisher Monitoring and Reintroduction. There's a package in there related to California Condor. So that there's a lot of pieces
overlap
in that general fund policy option packages that actually overlap with things that this task force has been advocating for. And frankly, we wanted to make sure we've got our, you know, they say if you don't ask, they'll never tell you no if you don't ask. But so we wanted to make sure we were making those asks.
Okay, got it.
Here. Thank you. Fully expecting that we're not going to receive all those. But nonetheless, we want to make sure that there's a recognition of the need.
Okay, thank you. Mike and then Paul.
I just want to frame something. The legislature imposed on behalf of the citizens of Oregon, even those yet unborn, an obligation to protect and manage non-game wildlife. It's a stewardship mandate. It's a heritage mandate. It's to maintain healthy ecosystems and wildlife opportunities for future generations. It has nothing to do with the taking of fish and wildlife. That's a separate mandate. So when we say, I have a sport pack every year, that has nothing to do with my responsibility or my family's, my wife and I's responsibility to heritage of stewardship of Oregon's natural resources, pollinators, bats, hummingbirds, any number. If you remember the survey, Oregon scored very highly ecosystem function. So think about the concept of the non-game, the heritage and stewardship responsibility. That's what's really unfunded at the department. Unfunded at the department. Claire can give the, you know, there was a weak non-game program, 12 individuals, 12 positions? 14, virtually gone. That's a different mandate than to manage the taking of fish and wildlife. I buy a sport pack, like I said, every year. That's my authorization to take public resources. Has nothing to do with my stewardship obligation as a citizen of the state of Oregon. So I frame it differently. And I think we should all frame it that way.
Okay, thank you. Paul?
And looking at these two different, the bottle bill versus the income tax, and thinking about trying to dedicate some funding for fish and wildlife, I think it might be easier or more sellable with the bottling fee to earmark that, dedicate it for fish and wildlife purposes versus an income tax surcharge, which really is nothing more than another general fund. You know, it's a chunk of general fund is what it is, and that may be a lot harder to earmark. Moreover, the bottle fee you can pass with a simple majority. The income tax, we're talking 3/5. So in terms of sellability, the bottling type fees may be quite a bit easier to get through the session than an income tax thing that requires 3/5 majority. So for that reason, I think we might want to keep the bottle thing on the table and in part of the mix.
So Jim, and then.
Well, with all due respect to Chairman Finley, I just have a different point of view about what people buy their hunting and fishing license for. Yes, they do buy their hunting and fishing license because they're required to buy their hunting and fishing license to take wildlife. But that is not, in my point of view, that is not completely separate from conservation. The department's own analysis shows that 80% of those funds basically go to basic conservation and habitat conservation, not just sportsman services.
I'm arguing that.
So I thought I heard you arguing that, but I want if that's what you're arguing, I want to disagree. One of the reasons why we have the hunting and fishing license exemption is honoring sportsmen for their contribution to general conservation.
Scott and then Jim.
I appreciate the conversation about one or two funding streams. I think it might be a little early until we have the rest of our public meetings. I think it'd be wise to hear from our other stakeholders before we come to a decision on it.
Okay. Jim?
So just a clarification about the general fund. And so the conversation has been an assumption that the current level of general fund monies would be sustained. And unless I'm totally mistaken, the tiers of funding that the department provided to us were based upon that assumption. So that we're looking at total implementation of $85 million plus the 30.5 that represents general fund. So just to clarify that.
Yeah, we're assuming all along that the general fund stays as is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's our assumption. Whether it gets sweeped or not, we don't know. But that's that's our assumption, that this is in addition to the general fund that the agency currently receives.
Yeah, just to clarify that, and then the second point is that some of this initial outreach that we've been doing suggests that there's different opinions about which of these two funding sources would be most appropriate. So we just lobby a little bit of don't make a decision yet. Let's get some more input.
Okay, so
Mark.
Yep. Oh, I'm sorry, Director.
I wanted to clarify one thing as well, and that Paul Don Heffner was commenting on the 3/5 majority required for the income tax surcharge, but I believe he said not for the bottle tax piece, and that's actually incorrect. Both of those would require a 3/5 majority. The only bottle option that would not require a 3/5 majority is the one that you took off the table, which is the unredeemed float piece. So that, and that's off the table. So I just, since you guys are all going to be discussing this over the next weeks or month, I want to make sure you knew that both will require, either of those options that are currently on the table will require a 3/5 majority.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Stand corrected.
Okay. So we're going to take a short break here, but during the break, if you could have discussion among yourselves or think about this, but so here's what I've heard so far. So if you go to this document here, you want to scratch off on tax return surcharge. You want to scratch off option one. It's no longer, it's unconstitutional. You want to scratch off option three. It's unconstitutional. And you want to scratch off on the beverage containers, option one, unredeemed deposits, because that's what I heard the task force say.
Right.
So all of our discussion is going to be around those remaining options. So we need to, during the break, if you could be thinking about this, we have some task force members that are saying, I think we ought to just have one proposal. I think this is the one I'm going to lobby for. I'm hearing others saying, we got to keep the rest of the proposals on the table. We got to continue having the discussion with our interest groups and then take those as a package to the legislature. So we need to close a loop on that, on a decision around that, whether we're going to go with one or go with the rest of them on the table. So if you just think about those, don't make a decision right now, but think about those so that we can see if we can get consensus from the task force on that. And then if you could, just think about this. We want to, we've got our criteria for the scenarios that we developed. And remember, is the funding sufficient to meet the needs? Is the funding sustainable? Is the funding stable and flexible? Is the funding diverse and equitable? Does the funding diversify or enhance engagement? Is the funding cost effective? Is it defensible? Is the funding politically feasible? Is the funding politically insulated? The other question that you could talk about during the break is, are there any, what other rationale do we want to have for any of these proposals that we would want to offer up besides the criteria that we have there? So, yes, Jim.
One question. My understanding was this was going to be our last task force meeting. My understanding originally was this was going to be our last task force meeting before our presentation to the legislature. Now I understand that we're going to have another one, so we actually have more time to get input before we make our final decision. Is that correct?
Well, that's what I'm going to propose. I mean, I don't make decisions. So it's the task force that makes decisions, but I'd like to see us. We aren't done talking to our constituency groups yet. We've had that little bit of discussion with some. We've got some feedback. We're still going to have some discussions with our constituent groups. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous. I like the education part, but we also need to make sure that we clearly hear, you know, boy, our group's going to be totally against that, or man, we really support this proposal. So having one more conversation with those constituent groups and then come back in September, and I realize this is an additional meeting, but come back in September that, okay, this is what we've heard, and now we're crafting the package to take to the legislature. And even the legislature package is going to be a preliminary one because they're going to give us direction. And I kind of see, I might be wrong, but I kind of see the legislature saying, well, we kind of like this, we don't like this, go back and put this together. And so we might still be asked to do some more crafting before we put a bill in for the February session. That's kind of what I'm thinking. And am I off? Am I on track? Okay, I see heads nodding yes, so that's kind of what I'm thinking. Our Jim and we've our executive team's kind of talked about that. So, Jim.
Yeah, I would add also, not only do we want to benefit from that additional input, but we as staff, you know, we play a note-taker translator exercise here. We're translating out what we've heard from you. We need to make sure that we're using the right languages and we've correctly captured the dialogue that you all have had. And doing that just electronically doesn't serve us well as staff. We're better served having you have a conversation and saying, yeah, we are either of one mind or we're differing opinions.
I'm gonna ask that question.
And then we translate that out.
Well, given that, the reason I was pushing so hard for one proposal is I think we need to have one proposal going for to the legislature. But if we're going to have another meeting in September, then I don't have any problem leaving both of them on the table to get our input and complete our input before we actually develop the proposal. Okay. So just as people go to their break and think about that, I was pushing real hard at this meeting because I thought this was our last meeting before the presentation. But if that's not the case, then we gain some things and we don't lose anything by making a preemptive decision right now. I just want us to make a preemptive decision before we go to the legislature.
Okay.
Thanks. A lot more jokes too.
So Paul just brought up a good question. So I'm going to look at Beth and Jim when I ask this question. So if you go to option, go to the tax return surcharge, first page, go to option 4. And then where the 1% surcharge, no exemptions, that's unconstitutional, isn't it? We can't do that.
Right.
No, 2 and 4 were viable. 1 and 3 were not.
Right, but within four, go to
number 4.
Yeah. Within 4.
Go to number 4, and the first chart there, or the first line, it says 1% tax, surtax, no exemptions. We can't do that, can we?
I think you can.
Oh, we can.
It's not a poll tax, it's a percentage of income.
Okay. So all of the proposals on option 4 are viable. Is that correct? Okay. So that clarifies that.
Good.
Okay, so any other comments? Seeing none, let's take about I'll say a 10-minute break, which means try to be back by quarter till and have some discussions among yourselves or think about it, and then we'll come back and we'll tie this all up. Okay, we grab our seats and hopefully our folks are still online. Had some constructive comments from the folks online. If you could get as close as you can to the microphone when you speak, the folks online are having a little difficulty hearing some of us talk. So if you could, when you do talk, please get as close to the mic as possible so that the folks on the phone can hear us speak. So, during the break, hopefully you had some good discussions. So, the first question before the group is, we've got a little bit of a disparity among task force members about whether we want to take one proposal forward or the group of proposals that we have as a preliminary recommendation. So, I'm going to ask Jim to give his opinion as unbiased third party here, what he would like to see, and then we'll open it up to discussion and we'll reach hopefully a consensus of the task force on that. So, Jim?
Well, you know, from an author's perspective, sure, one option is easier. However, I think we started engaging in dialogue with constituencies out there with a couple of options, asking them, you know, what their reaction is. I would suggest there's still value in that, given that we're not at the point yet of finalizing a report. So I think we would lobby for continuing to ask for feedback on two separate options. We also think there may be a couple other legal questions hanging in the wings that we need to ask about both of them.
Okay, so Nancy?
Yeah. Thanks. I would be curious, and I don't think.
Bathroom.
I don't think we necessarily need an answer today on this, but I would be curious to hear from our legislative representatives as to what would be most helpful or best for them to go forward with one strong proposal, to go forward with one proposal that we're recommending and potentially a backup proposal, or to have two that we feel, you know, either one that we're comfortable with. So I'd love to hear that kind of feedback from the legislature.
Okay. As soon as we're done, we'll ask Senator Whitsitt, Senator Edwards, and Representative Helm is out of the room right now. So, Claire?
Nancy said what I was going to say, too, but I also think that since we haven't met with many of the groups, for example, the Conservation Network doesn't meet for a couple more weeks, I think it would be wise to have, and we do have a September meeting, that we can take those out and get feedback. But, yeah, I'd like to hear from the legislators about ultimately what we take forward, one or two proposals, what might be the best strategy.
Okay. Anybody else want to weigh in? Okay. Well, Senator Whitsitt, what's your opinion on single versus options?
Just speaking for myself.
You're the one of the ones they said they couldn't hear very well.
Just speaking for myself, Mark. There
you go. Thank you, sir.
My wife says I mumble, and she's right. Just speaking from my own perspective, I think that probably two options would be. I think too many options are would be counterproductive, but a couple of viable options would be a good thing.
Okay.
And, kind of it kind of breaks up the opposition a little bit also, because there will always be, you know, whoever's ox is going to be gored is going to be pushing back, and so I think more than one option on the table would be a good thing.
Okay, thank you, Senator Edwards. Are you still on the phone?
Yeah, I think more than one option is preferable. Senator Woods has said, I think too many is not helpful, but if we come forward with just one proposal, while it may feel like all your energy and focus is behind that one proposal, no matter what, legislators are going to say, well, what else did you consider? And so some either variations of one proposal or more than one proposal, although not too many, I do think is helpful, partly so that legislators can understand that that the group didn't just zero in on one, or if you just even explain all the things that were considered, all the different proposals, to provide context for one proposal.
Okay, thank you very much. And Representative Helm is not in the room right now, so unless. Yes, Jim?
Well, therefore, listening to this, I think it's clear that we don't want to make a shortening decision right now. We want to at least go to our next meeting and listen to what we heard from our feedback. And we don't need to make the one versus two decision until that meeting. So let's just go ahead and go forward with that.
Okay, so everybody okay with that? Green card? Is everybody not? Everybody's supportive? Okay.
So, green card here.
We're unanimous then. We will carry forward the proposals that we've talked about that are still viable. Okay, so now let's, I want to go back to Senator Edwards. You raised a very valid concern. Our charge from the legislature was to identify and recommend potential alternative sustainable funding sources, which we spent the majority of our task force working on. Number three was to identify and recommend opportunities for the department to better achieve its mission and conservation objectives, which we're working on that too. Your concern is that direction number two, to develop recommendations on whether adjustments are necessary to ensure that relevant department program areas are funded in accordance with the intent and purpose set forth, that we have not addressed that to your satisfaction. I think that's the summary. So I've asked Jim to provide at least his, from a consultant's point of view, his thoughts on this, and then we need to have the discussion among the task force about where we would go with that. Because as I recall, The discussion a couple meetings ago, we did take a vote on this, or we did take a poll, and we said that we were going to leave that up to the External Budget Advisory Committee and the legislature to talk about the details. So, Jim, and then we'll open it up. So.
Well, that's correct. So two meetings ago, and Senator Witz and I, you were not present, there was a unanimous vote on this question, and it was looking at the charge of what program adjustments are necessary to ensure that relevant program areas are funded in accordance with the legislative intent. There was a differentiation in that conversation between general program adjustments, such as developing more conservation positions, as an example, or reducing fish and license fees and their contribution to the budget, versus going in doing a line-by-line budget exercise. And my sense of the group was there was no appetite for that. And there were the notes from that meeting indicate that folks felt that there's an external budget advisory committee that has that function within the Bureau, and that that's a legislative function ultimately. And so the vote of the group at that point was not to get into a line-by-line budget level assessment of program adjustments, but to keep it at a general level. And so some have been identified. They may not be satisfactory in terms of scope or level of detail, but there have been conversations at the work group levels on what program adjustments are necessary to meet the objectives that have been identified.
Yeah, and then I don't mean this to diss anybody on the panel, but we don't have the technical expertise on this panel to dive into ODF and W's budget. I sit on the EBAC, the External Budget Advisory Committee, and I understand budgets extremely well, and it's still very complicated, and there's a lot of details and a lot of moving parts on FTEs and partial FTEs and partial funding for this and general fund out of this and grant funded out of this, and there's just a lot of moving parts on putting together a biennial budget for an agency. And while we have some really smart people here, most of them, it would be, I think, somewhat difficult for them to dive into particulars of ODF&W's budget and say, I think we ought to move this position over here, or I think we ought to cut FTEs here and move things around. And I think I'm speaking on behalf of the task group. I think there was somewhat agreement on that we don't first have the time. We're pushed already to get this report done in time for the legislature, but we just don't have the time or the expertise to dive into some of the particular details. And what we said was, as Jim, and I'll just paraphrase it, we said that the External Budget Advisory Committee, which does see the budget in detail, the proposed budget, and makes recommendations to the agency, eventually it goes to the commission, who makes the final decision on what the recommendation is going to be to the legislature, and then the legislature, of course, makes the final decision on moving FTEs around or department programs around and what's going to get funded by what source. So that was, I think, the thinking of the task force was, is we just don't have the expertise to do that. So I'm going to have to fall on my sword in front of the legislative committee, unless the task force wants to go different direction, but just to say that, you know, we feel pretty strongly that we don't have the expertise or the ability to do that. And so we're not going to meet that legislative charge, and we're going to meet some of it because we're going to have some direction on the dollar amount, as Jim said, but we don't have the expertise to do that as the agency. So, Bruce?
I would just like to affirm what Mark said, and I've been on the External Budget Advisory Committee for years, and it's just amazing how little you can understand after 20 years of looking at that stuff. And it really goes beyond the Budget Advisory Committee. You know, when the department and the commission sends a budget, it goes to the Budget and Management Office and the Governor's Natural Resource Office, and then the Legislative Fiscal Office is looking at it. And every one of those entities has people who it's their job to know this stuff. And I would be really worried if we had engaged in that kind of process that we would not be doing a very good, very thoughtful job. I would certainly have opinions about things, but they wouldn't be much more than opinions. So I'd just like to affirm, when I read the legislation here, it asked us to look for funding sources for the Department of Fish and Wildlife and then to recommend program adjustments. You know, where does that funding, more funding or less funding needed? And we said we need more funding for conservation programs in particular and take some of the burden off license holders. I think we can check that box with good conscience. Anybody else? Jim?
Oh, I agree completely with what the two of you just said. And even if you don't get into line item by line item, there's always a clash. There's always a dynamic tension kind of in the philosophies of what the centerpiece of the department's work. When I worked for 30 years for ODFW, and the last six were as chief of fisheries. And I participated in the EBAC conversations as a staff member, and I participated in the legislature. And we always had a dynamic tension between people who think you need more conservation staff, you need more sportsman services to pay for their fees, you need less hatcheries, but wait a minute, hatcheries fuel the fisheries, and fisheries is the funding model for how we do conservation. You're being too responsive to landowners. No, you're not being responsive to landowners enough because they control the habitat. What about these damage programs? Somebody should just pay a consultant to do the damage programs. No. Well, what about these other agencies? They should be paying a fee if we're going to do our consulting. But if we don't do our consulting, they're going to make a decision without our advice, and it's not going to be good for fish and wildlife. So even at the highest level, this dynamic tension between people who think there should be more of this and less of that to pay for it plays out in the legislature. And at the end of the day, it is up to the legislature to listen to that dynamic tension, to get good staff advice from the department and from others, and basically cut that baby and make that decision. If we got into this here, we wouldn't be focusing on our primary job, which is how do we figure out a funding model that will work into the future and will provide at least the raw materials for the legislature to be able to make that decision between that dynamic tension. So it's not necessarily just a technical, we don't understand the technical line items of the budget. It's a counterproductive argument for us to get into when what the heart of this is a unanimity amongst all these people from different points of view that regardless of how you deal with that balancing decision and the legislature is going to deal with it, we don't have a funding model that will work, and it's going to get worse, and it's going to make that much, much more difficult down the road. Yes, whatever we come up with, there will still be that dynamic tension, and there will still be the need for the legislature to make decisions about balance and efficiencies, but it's not the centerpiece of what we should be doing.
Okay, anybody else want to weigh in?
Mark, I might say one more thing, too. So it may be a question of what we mean by program adjustments, because I think that you all have identified some very significant program adjustments. For example, you've at least preliminary recommended that grant administration be moved away from ODFNW to OWEP because they have more expertise in grant administration and would be cheaper. That's a significant program adjustment. You've recommended that there be more equity positions established at the department. Well, that changes a number of things in the budget when you do that. And you've recommended more contracting out for communications and education. So those kind of program adjustments have been identified through the work group process and seem to be more in line with the legislative intent, but that's just my personal reading.
Okay, Rob?
I would say the most significant program adjustment that work group one identified was significantly augmenting the science capacity and science work of the agency so that there is sound underpinning for decisions that are made. And so we would add science capacity and implementation capacity of the scientific work that would be added. So I think that's a very significant program adjustment as well.
So, Senator, excuse me.
My comments are going to be very similar, that augmenting the science capacity of the agency, and even though it's stated in the legislation, just finding the funding to be able to make program adjustments and shifts to fund the unfunded mandates of the agency, I think that's significant right there. And I do agree that I don't think it was the intent to get into line-by-line budget adjustments for all the reasons mentioned before. But I do think that, you know, in a sense, we have, as a task force, really begun to address some major programmatic shifts within the agency adjustments.
Okay. Thank you. So, Kenji, Mike, James, or Senator Edwards, do you have any comments you'd like to make?
No.
Okay. So, Senator, I hope this isn't something that, you know, is going to the task force is going to fall on your bad graces for this. But do you have any? It appears that this is the direction that we're moving. You're part of this group as an ex officio member. Do you have any, given what you've just heard, is this a deal killer for you?
Well, no, nothing's a deal killer, Mark. My reason for asking to be on the task force or as the Senate representative was to get into the budget process of the ODF&W and, for instance, ask questions like, why should 10% of the Oregon State Police Force be funded with angling and hunting licenses? ODF&W has, you know, right around 400 biologists on staff. What do they do? I'm sure they're all doing something, but I mean, do we need more biologists, or do we need to realign what some of them are doing? I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities. If the task force has no appetite for it, then I'm in the wrong place.
Okay. So I see everybody okay with that, where we are?
Yep.
Okay. So we've reaffirmed the decision that we've made before. So now let's, if you'll pull out the document, if you have it in front of you, the next item for us and it says House Bill 2402 Preliminary Framework for Recommendations. Now this is Jim's draft, and clearly he wants me to say this. This is a draft, and this is just a beginning process of our what we would look at. We don't even have the introduction written, as you can see on there. It has our charge on there. I'm just going to go through this by page. It has our challenge, our guiding principles that we agreed to, our funding objectives that we agreed to, the funding need. And remember, that came from, we asked the department to provide us some different funding scenarios, the status quo plus deferred maintenance and unfunded mandates, and funding of the mission and branding and marketing on page 7. And then it goes into the funding alternatives. Then it goes to the outcomes and measures, what are expected outcomes and the objectives of each of those. Then we go into program adjustments, levering partnerships, and then just a closing statement. So working off of this preliminary recommendation that Jim put together, we now want to have a discussion for other aspects of the task force's charge. It is this, and I know you've just seen this because Jim didn't get it out until late, but I mean he put a lot of work into this. Do you see anything preliminarily that you want to have more discussion about, or modifications or changes? And then we will hopefully have another meeting in September. I think we will, but where we can help craft this into further details and get us so to where we want to go. You know, is this too big? Is it just about the right size? And we know that the legislature gets a lot of reading material, but because this is a legislative committee, I hope that the legislative interim committees that are going to see this will have, this is the executive summary for, you've seen me with the document. I've got about 300 pages worth of notes here from in my document that we've worked through, but this is the executive summary of this. So, okay, let's start with.
Before folks jump in, just a couple of notes. One is, so this is essentially just a collection of the work you've done. And we just tried to organize it in the format of a report we might present to the legislature. One of the questions is, you know, is this the right format? Is it the right information we want to convey generally? We're not asking for you to sign off on the verbiage at this point. We think that's going to take more digestion. But we want to know whether we're heading in the right direction with this type of report. Particularly want to know what might be missing in terms of general content. And I can point out some things right up front. The whys really aren't in here. We have, this is what we're recommending, blah, blah, blah. But the supporting rationale for some of these recommendations isn't totally here. And needs to be added in.
You know, I haven't actually there. I haven't actually talked to Jim about this, but, you know, we've got the one document that's kind of the Q&A that we've been taking out to the various interest groups along with our little handout. We got that Q&A, and what that answers some questions, but what this does is it kind of puts it all together and kind of gets it in a little better format. So we had, Bruce wasn't first, I know he wasn't. Somebody else, okay, Claire.
But I didn't see that my question was answered on the back as I was wondering if somewhere we were going to make reference to the survey.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is there adequate weight given to the survey results?
Mentioned as an appendix.
I think it should be brought near the front that it wasn't just us talking to each other.
Good.
So, yeah, the survey is pretty telling. And I think the commission chair hit it right on the head. You know, Oregonians like ODF&W, and we need to make sure that that's part of our. So Bruce and then Jim.
Well, I was going to say the survey as well, but I would have then put in a special plea that you pick those portions of the survey that make the strongest case for our recommendations.
Yes, the survey is like how many, 200 pages? That's long. Jim.
I was just wondering if we need a couple little appendices on here that maybe summarize the survey, and I also thought we might also have one that summarizes the conversation we just had about the one, charge number two.
Very good.
So I can see a couple of little appendices you might want to put on this that kind of answer probable questions that are going to come.
Right.
Since we all got this last night, it just seems like it'd be difficult to go through it line by line. I'm just wondering about the timing of doing that. Maybe we can just consider this draft, read it at our leisure here, offer thoughts and suggestions, and then have a kind of a finalizing process next meeting.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, Rob.
Yeah, one thought is after, you know, we articulated the challenge statement before we had the survey done, and I think that the survey results support what we identified in the challenge statement somewhat blindly. So that might be the place to put it right in there, that there's affirmation of what we saw the challenge being based on what the public said.
Anybody else? We're staying at kind of 50,000 feet. We're not into too much detail here.
I think also adding a list of the stakeholders that we meet with just to give the legislature an idea of how we shop the ideas around.
Ah. Everybody like that? Who we talk to? Yeah. And hopefully we're not leaving anybody out. Okay. Yes.
I would just suggest in Section 11, which we've talked about quite a bit today, that rather than just punting in that first sentence, that we just speak to our limited ability to deal with specifics. And yet we do have some suggested program adjustments, but it does kind of read that we just said, no, we're just not doing it. And in reality, we've done some, and we were limited in our ability to really take that on in detail, just so that it doesn't strike other legislators the same way when they would.
So put the qualifying on that page 11 there where we talk about the program adjustments. Okay, good point. Anybody else? Initial thoughts? Yes, Rob.
I think we should spend some time trying to reinforce the statement of need. I think the need for funding has, in my view, been made, but I don't think it's articulated or drawn together here. Just in a quick look at this, and I think if we draw on some of the conversations that have occurred, the need will become clear, and I think it needs to be clear to the legislature and to everyone we talk to.
Okay, would you be willing to provide some of that input?
I will.
Okay, yeah. Provide it to Jim.
Excellent.
So, and anybody else that?
Yeah, I think maybe that's the when you're writing the crafting introduction, that's all based on the need, setting up the problem, which leads into the charge and the challenge statement. So.
Okay, on the phone, anybody on the phone? Any thoughts, input on the 50,000-foot level?
Not at this time.
Okay.
Patricia, I just joined by phone, but I'm on a layover, so I won't be on for very long. Just wanted to say that I was here.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Mark.
Nope, sorry. Nope, Senator.
Thank you, Mark. Generally, I just read through this a couple of times briefly, but I would like to see more emphasis put on improving hunting and fishing opportunities. I think if you get back here to toward the back of the deal, it says, to be addressed how hunting and fishing opportunities are being improved. I would certainly like to see that fleshed out a great deal more.
What page is that on? 11?
Page 11, the second paragraph.
Okay.
And then, I think it's on page 10, there is an expanded public awareness of hunting and fishing opportunities. And somewhere in here it talks about there's a perception of lost hunting and fishing opportunities. And I think... Living in the rural areas, I think it's more than a perception. So I'd like to see more emphasis put on specific items like predator control, habitat, partnerships with the Oregon Cattlemen Association, Farm Bureau, other private sector organizations to enhance habitat, recognize what private landowners provide for wildlife, not only hunting wildlife, but all wildlife. In eastern Oregon, if you don't have water, you don't have anything, and most of the water is man-developed. So, you know, if you didn't have the cattle on the range and you didn't have water for the cattle, you wouldn't have anything out there. If you read the journals of folks like Applegate and Williamson and others that came into eastern Oregon, they almost all starved to death because there was no game out there, because there was no water. And so, I mean, those are some of the things I think that when you talk about partnerships, I think the partnerships with private enterprises and private and organizations that represent them may be a lot more important than partnerships with other government agencies and NGOs, because those are the people who are providing the habitat, mm-hmm. at least in the country I live in.
Mm-hmm. So, Alicia, you're typing like crazy? Okay, you got it? No questions on? Okay, good. She got it. Anybody else? Okay, so we're going to speak for Jim here a little bit. So if you could review this in detail and get your comments back within the next week or so, maybe by the end of August at the latest.
Let's look at August 31st.
If you could have your comments and questions, or not questions, but input back to Jim by the end of August, we'd very much appreciate it. And Jim, is it okay as we are talking to the interest groups to use this document in lieu of, well, I guess we could still have the questions and answers, but maybe you just say this is preliminary. If anybody, interest groups have any input into it or your thoughts on that?
Or my immediate reaction would be to continue to use the briefing paper.
Okay.
So that there's continuity in the conversation that's already been underway. And I think this is way too detailed.
Okay, is everybody okay with that? Okay, so we'll continue to use the Task Force for Funding Fish and Wildlife Related Outdoor Recreation, the August 5th document, and then our little two-pager there.
Yeah, and so we have three informational pieces we prepared, and you know, they're not perfect because they were done very quickly, but there's a PowerPoint as well that we use with the commission, and then the flyer, and then the briefing paper. So feel free to use any and all of those.
Okay, so now let's move to the process for next steps. So you've heard me say it a couple times. So proposing, we have two options. One is to go back into our work groups and then come back together. Or the other option is just go ahead and review this stuff, talk to your various interest groups. We will revise this as we get input, and then we'll come back in about the middle of September, and then hopefully bless the document that we're going to take to the legislature. So Jim is the one that's proposing potentially the work groups. I don't like that idea. But
no, I see that. I didn't say I wanted to do that.
So I'm proposing that you do your homework, you get your input to Jim, you talk to your constituency groups, you get that input back to Jim or I, we incorporate that into there, we come back in September, and then we have a document that we can look at to say we're okay with this, it's not perfect, but we can live with it, and then that's what we take to the legislature, and we put that in a form of this is our preliminary recommendations. They give us direction, either thank you, we're done, you don't need to meet anymore, or thank you, we think there's some good stuff here, we want you to go back and work on it a little bit and craft some more things. We like this proposal, but we don't like this proposal. Whatever the direction that the legislature, the Senate committee and the House committee give us, then we would take that and go from there, if they so choose to do that. We work at their pleasure. So, Jim.
Oh, I agree with that. Rather than going to the work group, let's just schedule one more full task force meeting. And I really like what you said about when we get further input from our various meetings, let's get that input to Jim so that he could prepare a little bit of a briefing document, kind of summarizing what we've heard as a whole before our meeting, rather than just waiting for a report at the meeting. Let's try to get a couple days before our next meeting kind of a summary of who we've met with and what we've heard so far, both in terms of their preference for various proposals and their willingness to support, so that we'll be prepared at our next meeting really to fine-tune what our presentation will be to the legislature.
Yeah, Jim, I'm going to look at you when I do this, because so we've got this outreach recommendation schedule and assignments that folks have. It would be really cool if we could, as people report back to you or you ask them, to say, okay, I'm just going to grab the first one, the Outdoor Recreation Communities Leaders Group, and Robson, Kenji, take and have just a quick summary of what they said. And then, you know, the Wildlife Society, the Oregon Conservation, the Land Trust, you know, Farm Bureau, Oregon Cattlemen's, what they said, what recommendations. That would be really cool if we had a format that could say, here's what they said, here's where it's incorporated into the document or not incorporated into the document and why. That would be really powerful. Okay. Anybody else?
Got it.
Yep. Go ahead. On the phone.
Nope. This is Kenji. Got it. So we'll work on it.
Okay. Okay. So meeting in September. Is that everybody's agreeable to that?
Well, we have a meeting set for...
We have one on the calendar.
September 16th.
16th or 15th.
Yeah, that's a Friday, I think.
That's fine with me.
Yeah, 10 to 5. That's okay. You're correct. We already have that scheduled. So
that works.
That work for everybody?
And it would be here?
And that just gives us, well, including the weekend, about 4 days to put the final together.
Right, right, and assuming we have things in fairly good shape. So that we may not need 10 to 5. We may be able to reduce the length of the meeting.
Maybe 10 to noon or something. If we,
10
well,
to 1 or something.
Yeah.
10 to noon?
Keep it as tight as we can, as I hear you.
Right.
Okay, so we've got
you'll,
it.
You'll let us know about the time.
Yeah. Right now, why don't we just schedule it from 10 to 1, if that's okay with everybody.
Or 9 to noon.
Or we could do it at 9 to noon.
9 10 to noon would is be fine. Better.
Okay.
No, 10 would be better for me. I may be coming from further.
Okay.
Can you repeat the date again?
September 16th.
Oh, it's the 16th.
How many of you for 9 to noon? Hands raised. 1, 2... Three. How many of you are for 10 to noon? Okay. And how many of you don't care? Oh, boy. Let's do it 10 to noon.
10 to 1.
10 to 1. Excuse me. I'm sorry. 10 to 1.
The hunger, wait. Hunger will cut the meeting off. Good.
So it'll be for those who have to drive some distance to get here. So.
That's a Friday?
Yeah.
It's a Friday. Yeah. Okay. Let me get back to my agenda here. I think that's all I have on the agenda.
You're going to allow public comment. Public testimony?
Yeah, except for public comment. Anybody else have anything? Yes, Mike?
I just want to point out on page 4, after it says through the work groups, 5 key objectives of alternative sustainable funding. We talk about fully implementing the Oregon Conservation Strategy. Director Melcher has said time and time again, and I just want to reconfirm this with the task force. This was a budgeting document sent into the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for funding, not a comprehensive wildlife management strategy for the state. So we just maybe need to nuance some words in there to say as supplemented and amended or something, so the department has the option to reach out and do the things that are more than just a budget document to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for funding.
Okay, you got that? Okay. Anybody else? Okay, public comment? Anybody on public comment? Yes, come on up. Tom? It doesn't. Just get up close.
Well, I used to yell at basketball guys playing basketball when I was a coach, so voice projection's never been my problem. So, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I've been here at every one of this. I helped pass the bill that brought you all here, so I have a very personal interest in this, and I just want to bring up discussion. I know you've spent long and hard on discussing your two funding proposals, and I haven't heard everything because I've been running back and forth between this task force and the drought task force, and I wish people could figure out how to avoid having two important task force on the same day, but that's a different discussion. I just want to say that my organization thinks, and I think, both these will be tough to pass, but the people sitting in that have been sitting in the back room, Joe Rollator, Bob Olson, Lena, myself, are dedicated to whatever you do. And to be honest, we're the ones that are going to help you pass it rather than many of the groups that you're talking about, because we're the ones in the building every day. Second thing I want to say, as far as what Trout Unlimited supports, which Trout Unlimited is a 3,300 member group in this state, 150,000 across the nation of hunters and fishers that are conservationists. We are primarily white-collar people, doctors, lawyers, lots and lots of engineers, teachers. And having talked to my members here in the state, we favor the surcharge, and we think there shouldn't be exemption for hunters and fishers. And that's just our opinion. Hunters and fishers should also pay that surcharge, because we favor that paying that way with the idea that license fees could go down possibly if that passes, or at least stay the same. And we also make sure that we believe that funding the conservation strategy or funding non-fish and game wildlife conservation is very important, and is as important as funding hunting and fishing, because we are all conservationists believe that if what's good for non-game fish and wildlife is good for game fish and wildlife. So we urge you to, when you talk about this further, to look at not having exemption. I know that many groups are going to disagree with me on that, but hey, that's what opinions are for. So that's just what I want to share, and thank you for all the work you've done, and know that in 2017, which will be my last session, this will be one of my priorities, passing this funding. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Appreciate your input. Anybody else? Anybody else? Yes, sir.
I just have more of a question. This is Adam Meyer with the Oregon Conservation Network. Just more of a question, if folks want to bat it around really quickly. We're going to have this coming Friday a meeting of the minds with the conservation folks in Oregon. Are there specific questions that folks would like answered in our meetings? We're going to do an update. We're going to get people's opinions. I know this is happening with all the different groups and interest groups. So if there are specific things that we should be addressing or talking about during that would be very helpful to know in advance.
Any task force members have specific questions they'd like to hear from? Nope. Our goal is to educate and to listen. So that's what we want to do. We want to provide, this is where we are. These are all preliminary. No decisions have been made, no final decisions. What input do you have for us? Where can we tweak this thing? Are we on base? Are we off base? Tell us what you think.
Great. And
whoops, I got questions all over now.
Jim and I may be saying the same thing, and I think the third point is, if we're going for something that you all like, can we count on your support, your active support? And that's really helpful for us going forward if we know that we have a base.
Okay. Jim and then Claire?
That was exactly what I was going to say.
Okay.
We need to know, can we count on you guys to push this?
Okay, Claire?
I've heard this just from a few people, just informal conversations, not members of the task force, and I'd be interested in finding out later on how we frame this, and maybe in this document that we'll be working on. Some people say don't concentrate so much on mentioning the Oregon Conservation Strategy. I think Mike mentioned that, and even last meeting, I think Mike, the other Mike, said something about that. And I'd be interested in getting feedback about how we go forward and frame this for the legislature, given the fact that we do have, you know, legislative direction in the bill. But what's our strongest case? I mean, some people feel that I've talked to frame it in terms of what the state intends to accomplish with new funding, rather than implementation of documents and things like that. Maybe you can give us some feedback there.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate your input. Anybody else? Okay, thank you all for coming. We are adjourned at 11:40. At 11:40. Thank you all for coming. We are adjourned.